BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Louis Theroux, a BAFTA award-winning documentary maker. He's been taking audiences into other people's lives for over 20 years. Known for his immersive approach, he shares experiences with and sometimes lives alongside his subjects, who frequently exist on the margins of society. Audiences might tune in to see him as an Englishman abroad. His mild, quizzical TV persona is usually a stark contrast to his extreme surroundings, but they tend to leave with a sense of common ground with his subjects, whether they like it or not. He's filmed with criminal gangs, religious and political extremists, addicts and prisoners, and says you have to get to know the people at the heart of the story. Usually, that means getting to like them. Louis Theroux, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been making documentaries for over 2 decades now, and your subjects often live lives that seem strange to the outside world. What's the appeal of doing that work?
You know, it's not something I have a brilliant answer for. I think it runs so deep with me that to some extent I can't quite explain it. I just know that it's a comfortable place for me and has been ever since I was a child, really. When you are on a hillside in Idaho with a gun nut, let's say, and he's predicting the end of the world, suddenly things like electricity bills or small marital arguments don't feel so important.
Yeah. And you're known for this very placid on-screen presence. How important is it for you not to judge the people that you're working with?
You know, I think there's a misconception around that, because I feel as though almost all the programmes I make are, in a sense, journeys of judgment. It's not as though I arrive, you know, among the neo-Nazis, let's say, and say, well, I've heard a lot about Nazis, but I don't really know what I think about it. You know, there's definitely some preconceptions that I carry with me, but I attempt to interrogate the process of decision-making or the psychological quirks that lie behind extreme lifestyle choices or stories that are around mental illness. It's more to do with attempting to see how people deal with really difficult situations.
And what do you see as your place in the documentary?
I am the audience surrogate. I have to represent a kind of normal-ish set of assumptions. I think it's something to do with attempting to form more than usually close journalistic relationships with people in difficult situations. But it's not friendship, and it's important to remember that. I'm there as a journalist. I'm not a social worker. And at the end, you have to follow the truth.
Now, obviously, I'm here interviewing an interviewer. What kind of interviewee are you, do you think? And as an expert interviewer, do you have any advice on how I get you to open up?
I think I'm a pretty obliging interviewee. But I think what I do have is certain defence strategies.
Go on.
I would avoid the question, probably, but I wouldn't try and do it too nakedly or obviously. Mm. And then I'm just quite comfortable with my line of defence on certain subjects. And I think as a journalist too, other journalists sometimes see me as fair game. So they sort of think, well, I'm going to Louis Theroux him. And so I have to be prepared for that.
Noted. Thanks very much, Louis. It's time to go to the music. Tell us about your first disc today.
I love Marvin Gaye, especially in my 20s when I was digging into vinyl in secondhand shops in New York. I would explore a lot of old, well, soul records in general, but Marvin Gaye especially. This is from his favourite album of mine, I Want You, and it's a track called All the Way Around.
You just ran away from me. Oh,
Louis Theroux, I was interested to hear you talking about the film that you made about Scientology, because you said you wanted to tell the truth, which struck me as a very definite article, and you know, the truth rather than a truth.
I think what I mean by telling the truth is just these are journalistic endeavours, so that comes first. At the same time, I'm attempting to tell a story that will engage people. And I mean, I think what it comes down to, if I can boil it down, which I don't really like to do because it's sort of demystifying, but I just sort of think that we are all much more complicated than we let on. And we sort of go around judging people and we go around sort of stigmatizing people. But actually, if we sort of opened up our minds like cabinets, you just see so much weird stuff in there. I mean, stuff that would be deeply embarrassing and hard to justify. I mean, I think the whole idea of us having stable personalities is kind of flawed. And the idea of us having consistent desires is flawed. We're full of these contradictory impulses, some of which are quite dark. And I think the more that I can get into places that disrupt that. So I think the idea of, like, am I trying to tell the truth? Well, that's part of it. But I'm genuinely trying to take viewers to a place that's got some self-conflict that involves them being made uncomfortable.
You've described your need to be liked as lamentable and your desire to interview people as an emotional prophylactic. What's going on there, do you
think? God, where did I say that? Was that in an interview? I wish I knew. I mean, I think it's a weakness in me that I do like to be liked. I think there's a lot of strength and power in not being easily shamed. I tend to think that's where Trump gets his power from. He seems unshameable. I think I'm quite easily shamed. I'm not saying I want to be more like Trump, by the way, but I'd like to be less easily affected by what other people say about me.
Time for some more music. It's your second disc. Why have you chosen it?
Okay, so when I was growing up, I grew up in South London, and my parents, this was in the days of vinyl, and they had a copy of Jesus Christ Superstar. It was very battered, the album, and it skipped, and there were certain bits that repeated constantly, but we listened to it endlessly, my brother and I, and this was our favourite track, was Heaven on Their Minds.
My mind is clearer now. At last, all too well, I can see where we all soon will be. If you strip away from the man, you will see where we all soon will be. Jesus!
Murray Head with Heaven on Their Minds from the album Jesus Christ Superstar, composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. So Louis Theroux, take me back to the first time that you wrapped your ears around that album. You were born in 1970. What were you like as a kid?
Well, I was a contradictory character because I was the second of two brothers and I was sort of allowed to be the naughty, silly one. And I was sort of boisterous and I was a bit of a joker. And at the same time, I was quite sensitive. So I oscillated between being naughty and out of control and then coming home and saying to my mum, you know, I don't think they understand me at school.
Oh, that sounds like you were vibrating on quite a high frequency there.
Is that the diagnosis? Is that a clinical term?
Well, it just sounds quite stressful. You're sort of up there emotionally.
I don't know what to put it down to, but I tend to think that actually it served me quite well in work because I am acutely tuned into how I'm feeling, but how other people are feeling. But then occasionally I feel compelled to say something or do something inappropriate.
So you just like to disrupt it every now and again, throw in a dead cat or whatever.
Yeah, and then if people are upset by it, then I get upset. So it's all a bit contradictory.
Your mother, Anne, was a BBC World Service radio producer and your father's the novelist, Paul Theroux. What were they like as parents?
Well, I feel grateful to have had them as parents and to still have them. And they were sort of children of the 60s in the sense that they were sort of rebelling against what they'd been brought up with. They came from church-going families. My dad, a Catholic family in Boston, Massachusetts. My mum, South London, Anglican family. And so they were a bit more free-spirited. It was all flares, and my mum was a working woman, first generation university educated. So there was, I think, a feeling that we're going to not make the mistakes of the past, and, you know, that we're groovy and the kids can be groovy. I mean, they didn't use the word groovy that much, but that was the sort of feeling. Does that sort of make sense? It was like, if you, when you're old enough, you can choose if you want to be have a religion. And I remember sometimes thinking, why haven't we been baptized when all my cousins have been baptized in America? And my mum saying, well, when you're old enough to decide, you know, you can decide whether you want to be baptized. It was that sort of attitude.
Intellectually bohemian, perhaps.
Yeah. Book learning was very highly prized. Well, reading in general and a sort of global perspective, because they'd met in Africa and also lived in Singapore. The World Service, where my mum worked, was often on. And there were, a big thing was knowing the capitals of foreign countries. That was my dad's sort of, I don't know, if he'd gone on Mastermind, that would have been his special subject. And so the feeling was, you know, there's a vast world out there. We don't belong to any particular tribe other than possibly the Republic of Letters.
Mm. You've described your father as complex. Did he seem mysterious to you?
Not really. I think he was a very hands-on dad in the sense of, you know, sort of hugging and, you know, loving. And he worked at home. So he wasn't a distant figure, although he did travel quite a lot. But I remember I would come home and he'd be behind his desk, wreathed in pipe smoke. And I'd sort of look in on him. And he would work, I would say, every day of the week, including weekends. He'd be at least for a few hours up there tapping away on his typewriter. And then I would get little insights into his other life through reading his books.
What's that like then, having that kind of access to a part of your father's personality that most kids don't?
Well, it's an odd thing reading a kind of graphic sex scene in a novel that your dad's written. It doesn't blow your mind, but it's a bit like, I wonder if my dad's done that. When you're sort of 7 or 8 years old. And there's quite a bit of drug taking in some of the travel books and in some of the sort of semi-autobiographical-ish novels. There's quite a bit of extramarital sex. So, you know, I think there's worse things in life, but you do have to process it a bit.
Tell me about your extended family. I read that you had a grandmother who told you some rather morbid stories.
Well, my mum's mum, Betty Castle, we were very close to both of them. We'd go and stay with them in Dorset. So my English grandma, I don't know, she just had a taste for macabre stories. I don't know. We'd go on the beach and she'd say, if you ever see a rusty spade, you must be careful because you could accidentally jam it into your foot and then you'll get some kind of blood poisoning and get lockjaw and you'll never be able to eat and drink again. So it was that kind of thing.
And did you like her stories?
Yeah, I loved them. There seemed to be some sort of, I don't know, moral to them or something about people not following the lesson or just the inhumanity of man to man.
Let's have another track, Louis Theroux. What's your third disc and why have you chosen it?
I'm a big fan of The Smiths and in my university days, I listened to them a lot and this was one of my favourite tracks. It's Panic.
Smiths and Panic. Louis Theroux, apparently you asked to go to boarding school. Why?
Well, I think it was assumed because my brother had asked. And I asked him about this recently because we only lived about a half hour cycle ride from Westminster where we went. And I don't know for sure, but I think it was partly due to us reading books by Enid Blyton. We started with the St. Clair's books and then we moved on to the Mallory Towers books. And it's a bit embarrassing to admit this because I don't think they're written, maybe I shouldn't say this, I don't think they're written for boys, certainly as a boy.
How would you describe them for anybody who hasn't
read
them?
Okay, so they are a bit like Harry Potter, but with no magic. So they're all set at girls' boarding schools, and they're about girls having midnight feasts, and sometimes they start pranks. Always there's an episode where a girl swims too far out to sea and nearly drowns, or some gypsies, her term, not mine. I think they ended up helping catch someone, or a child pretending to be an aristocrat and turning out to just be a kind of, again, her term, lowborn. Yeah. I mean, I could go on and on. There's always a wacky French teacher and they play pranks on her. It's that kind of thing.
So you and Marcel were fans of the Mallory Towers books?
Yes, and the St. Clair's one. We came to those first. And I think based on that, we thought, well, maybe that's what boarding schools like, endless midnight feasts and French teachers.
I mean, was it? I know that you said San Quentin Prison reminded you of Westminster.
It did a bit, yeah. Well, there's something about a lot of males, be they, you know, boys or men, in a confined space, something about the improvised physical fabric, which is all higgledy-piggledy. And then, I hesitate to say this, a certain level of situational homosexuality, which I think, I hope I'm not scandalising anyone, is relatively common, definitely in prison and to an extent in all male boarding schools. I mean, I could go on. There's quite a lot of other similarities. Cliquishness and a sort of Darwinian atmosphere. But you don't go around stabbing people at Westminster.
It's a different kind of survival of the fittest.
It's more of a metaphorical melee based on being verbally cutting, being able to take people down.
So you said you spoke to Marcel about that recently and said, you know, why did we go to boarding school half an hour away from our house? What did he say?
I think he copped to the fact that it had been his suggestion. I mean, there's always a temptation to throw your parents under the bus and say, what were they thinking? Didn't they love us? But I think it was more coming from him. And then because I just slipstreamed behind whatever he wanted to do, you know, because I looked up to him, when he said Westminster and boarding school, I just said, yeah, great, let's do that.
After you left, you took a road trip around the US. What was your relationship to American culture then? Because obviously, you know, your dad was American and you'd spent time there growing up. So you must already have had a connection to it.
I grew up thinking of myself really as English, I suppose, or British. But I think along the way, my dad was managing to smuggle in certain American values. And then in the summer, when we spent time on Cape Cod with the sort of American family, he would try and sort of instill a few more kind of outdoorsy, manly American values, because he'd been an Eagle Scout and he knew about tying all kinds of knots and camping and starting fires. I think he had mixed feelings when he saw that we were turning, or rather like our schooling, which he had imposed on us, was turning us into effete little English twerps. So we didn't have a very typical experience of American culture. He used to let us drink a lot of Coke and eat, you know, American breakfast cereals, which then weren't in the UK. My friends used to say, oh, it must be amazing. I'd love to go to LA and it must be amazing. What's it like in New York? And I just would think, I have no idea. All I know is being really bored at a house while my dad writes. You know, we were in the middle of the woods and we would just count the minutes until a cousin or an uncle would come over and just spend our time basically driving each other mental and hacking paths through the woods and just basically going out of our minds.
Well, it's time to go to the heart of the American city now, I believe, with your next disc. Tell me about this one.
Well, when I was about 17 or so, my friend Joe Cornish gave me a compilation tape and it had a track on it by Eric B. and Rakim, Paid in Full. And this was really a big moment for me because although I'd known about rap before then, this was the first time I listened to a rap record that felt, I don't know, just really poetic and interesting and different. Thinking of a master plan. Step with the record. Step with the record. Thinking of a master plan. Step with the record. Step with the record. Thinking of a master plan. To
this ain't nothing but sweat inside my hands. So I dig into my pocket, all my money spent. So I get deeper, but still coming up with lint. So I start my mission, leave my residence, thinking how could I get some dead presidents. I need money. I used to be a stick up kid, so I think of all the devious things I did. I used to roll up, roll up, roll up.
Eric B. and Rakim, Paid in Full, remixed by Cold Cut. Louis Theroux, there's quite a lot of home video footage, I suppose you'd call it, of you and Joe Cornish, who you mentioned introduced you to that track, and Adam Buxton, all friends together at school, messing about with camcorders quite a lot in your teens.
Yeah, I really owe them a lot because they were just very switched on about not just music, but films and comedy. And loved doing little sketches and improvising bits of comedy and making films. And I suppose until then, I hadn't really thought of myself as a performer. But just being a little part of it, I think built my confidence up a bit. Although I remember thinking, I'm not actually even the funniest member of my little group of friends. So in that way, it was slightly preying on my mind when I first got the call to do TV.
Well, we'll come to that. First, tell me about uni. You studied modern history at Oxford. What did the place do for you?
Well, basically, I worked. I just applied myself. And something terrible happened, which was at the end of my first term, one of the tutors took me aside and said something along the lines of, yeah, you've got what it takes. We think you're material for getting a first. That's where we see you going. And until then, it hadn't really been in my mind. And then as a result of that, I began thinking, well, I suppose I better not let him down then. And basically studying really did dominate my experience of being there.
And how did you do? Did you get the first?
Yeah, I did. And I sometimes think I slightly wasted my university experience by studying too much. Obviously, I did, you know, go to parties and, you know, of a Friday or a Saturday, I was often to be seen going up and down the Cowley Road looking for the house that music was coming out of, you know.
I remember that.
Kind listening. Of scavenging parties where there was no one else that I knew there, but I just had a knock on the door or wander in. But I think at some level, I've had a background level of anxiety that goes through my life. And one of the ways I would assuage it was by doing well at work. And that applied then, and to some extent it still applies.
Yeah. So tell us how you got your break in TV. It came after Oxford when you were in the US.
Well, until then I'd been like a greyhound racing around a track, chasing the furry object, whatever it is, knowing sort of what I was supposed to do. And then suddenly it's like, right, you're off the track now. And you just don't know. I didn't know what to do. So for lack of other options, I went to America. I had a US passport through my dad. And I'd done a bit of student journalism at Oxford. So I ended up on a local paper in San Jose. I more or less stuck a pin in a map and sort of went there. And then that led to a job on a magazine in New York. And then some friends said that Michael Moore, the documentary maker, was starting a new TV show co-funded by the BBC, and he was looking for a British correspondent, and I should come along and have a chat. And although I was completely unqualified and would never have seen myself as someone who could do that, I think that's what he quite liked. I think that the level of incompetence that I brought to the job was for him a big plus. And I was confused because I wanted nothing more than to do the job well. I mean, I remember I had a jacket that I bought from a thrift store, like a secondhand shop, and I had one sort of shirt with a collar. So I tried to look like a correspondent, and I looked absolutely hopeless. I was doing my best impersonation of a polished TV performer. I don't want to completely trash myself. Like, I did have a certain journalistic focus. You know, I could ask a series of questions, and I did listen. But I think what he realised was that this sort of bookish, to all intents and purposes, sort of English person, set, you know, when contrasted with a Ku Klux Klansman or a kind of millenarian cult member in Montana, was quite funny.
What did you learn working for him?
He had habits of work that were very unusual to do with bringing documentary values to TV. And his attitude was, you go and find someone who's up to no good, really. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but that kind of defines a great amount of the Roger and me approach is you don't go and find sad auto workers who've been laid off. Because the subject of Roger and me is his hometown of Flint that's been decimated by layoffs in the auto industry. And you don't go and tell sob stories about them. You go find the people who are up to no good or who are sort of their fellow travellers or their useful idiots and just hang out with them and sort of ask them silly questions. And it sounds a bit unkind maybe, but get them to say something stupid that's sort of funny. And I'm aware I'm being a bit reductive, but that was sort of the approach that I took with me for a while, was go after slightly dodgy or questionable people and be very polite and disarming, but look for comedy in whatever they say.
Time for some more music. It's your fifth disc. Tell us about this one.
When I was living in San Jose, I used to buy a lot of secondhand records, and one of them was the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. And I love this track. It's the sort of the ultimate passive-aggressive love song. Don't think twice, it's all right.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby. Even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby. It'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Bob Dylan and Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. Louis Theroux, the first series of Weird Weekends aired in 1998. How did you sell it to the BBC?
I remember after TV Nation ended, the show I'd worked with Michael Moore on, they'd signed me to a development deal, so I had to come up with ideas. But Weird Weekends was basically a kind of a long-form version of segments that I'd done at TV Nation. And the producer who'd been assigned to sort of work with me came out to New York one day and took me for lunch and said, well, they've decided to commission the Weird Weekends idea, which wasn't my title, incidentally. I thought, yeah, it's a bit reductive, isn't it? And the alliteration. I think I lobbied for, like, well, couldn't it just be Unusual Weekends or something like that? And then he said, it's called Louis Theroux's Weird Weekends. And I said, well, why have they put my name in the title? No one knows who I am. That's ridiculous. And they said, we're going to make four of them and they're 50 minutes each. And I said, well, 50 minutes seems too long. You know, used to making 9-minute segments. And four, couldn't we just make one and see how it goes? So I sort of tried to haggle them down. And I remember him looking at me like, you don't really understand how TV works, do you? You basically grab as many commissions as you can.
Yes, you were being handed an enormous opportunity at a very young age. You filmed in America. There were subjects, including survivalists, UFO believers, porn stars, born-again Christians. Why in the US, not the UK?
Well, by then I'd figured out that the contrast of me as a sort of British person against an American backdrop was key to how it would all work. So the idea was definitely conceived as me exploring extreme worlds in America. And I think the development between TV Nation and Weird Weekends was in making 50-minute shows, I suddenly realised, well, I can't just be going out making fun of people for 50 minutes. And I think I had a degree of guilt or a sort of complicated feeling when I was doing stories that it was a bit weird just to sort of try and elicit ridiculous statements and a bit unkind. And so I tried to infuse Weird Weekends with a little bit more kindness and a sense that actually these are people who have real humanity and whose lifestyles are putting them on the edge in a way that might be silly in some ways, but in other ways is kind of poignant and a bit sad.
So you made three series of Weird Weekends, and you followed that with When Louis Met, which was broadcast on BBC Two. And there you really entered the lives of your subjects, one of whom was Jimmy Savile, who you made a documentary with in 2000. Many years later, after the horrendous truth about him had been revealed after his death, you revisited that documentary. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, I suppose a couple of reasons. One was I was being asked about it the whole time and it was almost becoming a distraction. But more than that, I suppose I felt that I wanted to figure out how it was that I'd missed what I'd missed. I wanted to do a kind of personal and professional stock-taking and to sit down with victims and talk to them about their experiences.
And how did that experience affect you?
Well, I mean, I think it's been traumatic for the country. In a way, the process of making the programme was more a little bit more cathartic. You feel like the victims can at least give you the permission to feel okay about things. Well, I want to say this right, because partly what it is it's something very conflicting about reading about crimes and predatory activity, while also knowing that this was someone who you sort of quite liked, and trying to square that in your own mind. And what you find is, not always, but sometimes, victims of serious sexual assault experience a similar ambivalence. Some experience just pure loathing, and then some experience something more complicated. And I think in talking about complicated emotions, that's a helpful thing.
It's time for some music. Let's hear your next track. Why have you chosen this disc?
Well, I met my wife at a BBC Christmas party in late 2002. And on our third or fourth date together, we were at a nightclub and this track came on. And although I knew that she was very special and that I was falling in love with her, there was a kind of catalyzing moment when I saw her dance. I'd always thought of myself as a reasonably good dancer, although many would disagree. But when I saw her, I just thought, wow, the way she moved, I don't know, she just seemed to transcend and go into a different dimension of physical movement. So I have a special soft spot for this song, which is What's Love by Fat Joe featuring Ashanti. Got to do it.
Let you know from the gate, I don't go down, lady. I want a chick with thick hips and licks her lips. She could be the office type, but like the strip. Girl, you get me aroused, how you look in my eye. But you talk too much, man, you're ruining my high.
Fat Joe featuring Ashanti and What's Love. Louis Theroux, that's the second hip-hop track you've chosen, and I think you actually have rapped in the past, am I right?
Well, I've rapped among friends, and I did once rap during an episode of Weird Weekends about the Dirty South rap scene. I don't consider myself a rapper.
So you're not going to MC for us right now? Not going to spit some bars?
What was the... My money don't jiggle, jiggle, it folds. I like to see you wiggle, wiggle, for sure. It makes me want to dribble, dribble. You know, driving in my Fiat. You really have to see it. I could go on.
I mean, enjoying it.
6 feet two in a compact, no slack, but luckily the seats go back. I got a knack to relax in my mind. Sipping some, no, I feel fine and sipping on red, red wine. it's a little embarrassing. As a rap fan, I always feel I'm kind of sort of committing sacrilege by doing it so badly. I didn't even write that rap. It was written by Rhys and Bigelow. I mean, I had some input.
It was a collab.
It was a collabo.
You became a dad to the first of three boys in 2006. What sort of father are you?
Well, you should really ask them. I'm quite a silly dad. Nancy says I'm too silly. I mean, I'm definitely down on my hands and knees doing the Lego or the Duplo or the Mega Blocks or whatever it is. I'm kind of a classic dad joke dad. I do travel a bit for work, so I'm conscious that I'm occasionally an absentee dad. We'll find out in about 20 years, probably, how good a dad I am when their misery memoirs come out.
Around the time, you know, you had your family, you also made a move into serious documentaries, gambling, serial murderers, gang members, big game hunters, drug addiction, all different subjects that you've covered. Why did you choose to change tack?
It wasn't really a conscious decision. I think I became aware that the imperative of being funny was in danger of holding us back from doing the best stories. We did one about a brothel that had quite a bit of darkness to it, and then San Quentin Prison. Then there was one about a mental hospital for paedophiles. And I think maybe the biggest transition was when I did a program about people with dementia in a care home facility in Phoenix. And it was the first time I'd ever done a show in which really no one was doing anything but their best. And I think since then it's become my MO to always look not just for... It's not really that the story's about the person with whatever the condition is or the mental illness. You're looking at families and relationships, and they're all almost equal partners in the story, and you just see how they're all grappling with it. You know, it's not that there's a person with dementia, there's a family that's grappling with dementia. And, you know, I was pleased with how it turned out, and after that I thought, wow, this whole other realm of storytelling is open to us.
Is it difficult to stop yourself becoming too involved with the lives of those people sometimes? You know, do you kind of take on a relationship with a subject and sometimes find it difficult to let go?
I hope I don't sound too cold-blooded if I say no. I mean, I think it's a clear line that I'm there as a journalist. I like to try and be a friendly presence, and I take an interest in the people, and afterwards I will, a few months or a year or two down the line, see how everyone's doing. I think the only times where there is a feeling of difficulty or awkwardness is when you worry that you might in some way be contributing negatively to the situation. I'm thinking of a time when we made a program in Cedars-Sinai Medical Center about patients who were facing life-threatening conditions, and due to, I think, a misunderstanding, we ended up filming a scene where a family was informed that it was likely that a very loved son and brother would probably never wake up from his non-responsive state. This was, as you can imagine, an absolute bombshell for them, and part of it was, why is the crew here filming this? And we left the room immediately. But it's those situations where you think a contributor is not signed up to what's going on, and you think you've actually added to the pain in some way.
And how do you deal with that? What's the impact of something like that on you?
Well, you feel bad, and you just... And I should say, it usually falls to either the director or the producer that I work with to make the necessary apologies, to make sure it doesn't happen again, and to fix the situation. And I think a common misconception, by the way, is that I'm sort of there by myself, you know. And obviously people, if they think about it, they know that I'm being filmed, so there's a crew there. I think sometimes I get a little too much both credit and very occasionally blame for what happens in the programs. They are absolutely collaborative endeavors. And in fact, it's the directors that, as it were, own the programs. They're in charge on location. They drive the edit. And so I feel sometimes a little bit fraudulent because I sort of think people think that I do more than I do.
Time to go to the music. Tell me about your seventh disc and why you've chosen it.
Well, as a family, we have spent quite a bit of time going back and forth from London and California, Los Angeles specifically. And this is a beautiful song about California by Joni Mitchell.
Sitting in a park in Paris, France, reading the news and it sure looks bad. They won't give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Oh, but California, California, coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset peak. California, I'm coming home.
Joni Mitchell and California. Louis Theroux, making documentaries can be quite intense. How easy do you find it to leave work and de-stress?
Well, most of the time, very easy. And I think the guilty secret of many people who work in TV and have young families is that it can be quite relaxing on location compared with the chaos of home life. And I think the stressful part is probably before you go away. And so I do a lot of displacement activity, like cooking, mainly chopping onions, making some pasta sauces or something, just to keep busy. Taking rubbish out, you know, tidying the Lego, finding lost bits of puzzles, that kind of thing.
20 years of making documentaries behind you and under your belt. Which subject do you think has changed you the most?
Well, I don't really like to bring it up again, but I suppose going through the whole experience of making the first Jimmy Savile programme, and then, well, I should say this right, because I knew that there was something that I hadn't seen. I had an idea. I hadn't really figured out what his private life revolved around, but I never imagined it would be as dark as it turned out to be. I'd remained in contact with him a little bit after I'd made the first programme. So while I'm sort of still quite proud of the first programme, I'm still a bit confused about how I was able to sort of experience him as a somewhat likable person in the sort of year or two afterwards after making it. That is something I kind of think upon.
And how has it changed you?
In various ways. I think it put the BBC under an enormous amount of pressure for very understandable reasons. And I think when people are under pressure, you see them either at their best or at their worst. And on occasion, I felt I saw people in a human way trying to protect themselves. And I think I saw people, again, in a sort of understandable way, looking to cast blame. And I don't mean necessarily at work. I sort of mean generally throughout society. I don't know. As much as I cover dark subjects, I'm actually quite a positive person and tend to see the best in people. So when you have experience of people doing things that are, you know, nakedly self-interested or unkind, it kind of darkens your view of the world a tiny bit.
Do you do things differently now because of that? Or see things differently now?
I mean, in a journalistic way, I think I'm part of the whole process of being educated about how sexual abuse takes place and the way in which it often can take years to even realise that you've been abused. And I think, as odd as it may sound, I sometimes come up against the fact that I'm not as emotionally... I don't have a level of emotional self-knowledge that that I maybe should have. I may be like a lot of men in that respect. So there's a slightly naive view that maybe is common to some men, that if abuse happens, you recognise it as abuse straight away. And of course, that's really not how it works in a real world setting. So I think it was something that I maybe had to learn, and that I'd like to think that I bring that understanding now to my work and also just as a human being.
It's time to cast you away to a desert island then, Louis. How do you think you'll get on?
Not that well, if I'm honest. I don't do well in solitude. And it's odd because I'm not massively outgoing. Social arrangements make me a bit anxious. So I rely on my wife for a lot of that. And she's really outgoing and funny. And so she's got this wide circle of great friends and sort of brings me along. and then I can sort of be part of that circle. Whereas on a desert island, she won't be there. So I'm going to struggle. And I go a bit out of my mind. You know, I can't work out if I'm thinking my thoughts or my thoughts are thinking me. And I think I'd start falling apart quite quickly.
Let's go to the music then. This is your final disc. Why have you chosen
it? On that happy thought. I love a bit of bossa nova. And this is a kind of bossa nova classic written and performed by Antonio Carlos Jobim with some jazz flute by Herbie Mann. And it reminds me of my kids because it's one of those tracks that they've latched onto as well. They call it the sort of Baba Dudem song because it's got some sort of scat singing at the end. It's one note samba.
This is just a little samba built upon a single note. Other notes are bound to follow, but the root is still that note. This new one is just the consequence of the one we've just been through, as I'm bound to be the unavoidable consequence of you. There's so many people who can talk and talk and talk and just say nothing or nearly nothing. I have used up all the scale I know, and at the end I've come to nothing or nearly nothing.
Antonio Carlos Jobim and Herbie Mann, One Note Samba. Louis Theroux, it's time to give you the books, the complete works of Shakespeare, the Bible, and one of your choice. What would you like?
I would like In Remembrance of Things Past by Marcel Proust. I read the first volume as a teenager and I loved it. And I thought, well, one day I'll read the rest of them. And of course, that's never happened. So I'd like to do it. And so much of it is about someone recollecting his life in tranquility. And it feels apropos to sort of use my solitude to sort of do that.
I can also give you a luxury item. What would you like?
Well, I was thinking about a puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle. I Googled it and there's one that has 40,000 pieces. I was once on a cruise with Anne Widdecombe for work. And one of the things they did on board was everyone would sort of walk past this table that had a puzzle on it and just do a few bits, you know, through the day just to pass the time. And it felt very civilized. I also used to do puzzles with my grandparents down in Dorset. So it's got nice associations for me.
And finally, which track would you like to save from the eight that you've told us about today?
For some reason, I'm going to take Heaven on Their Minds from Jesus Christ Superstar. And I don't really know why. I've listened to it all my life and I've never really got tired of it. So maybe it's just an evergreen. Maybe it never gets old.
That must be it. Louis Theroux, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Louis. Personally, I'm not a Jigsaw fan. As I'm sure you know by now, there are over 2,000 editions of Desert Island Discs in our back catalogue that you can listen to anytime via BBC Sounds. But we couldn't resist the opportunity to play you a short extract of the interview with Louis' dad, writer Paul Theroux, recorded in 1976 with the creator and first presenter of Desert Island Discs, Roy Plumley.
As a youngster, what did you want to be?
I wanted to be a doctor, actually, or a kind of medical missionary. I saw myself going to distant places and doing good.
You did, in fact, start to read medicine.
Yes, I was a medical student for about 4 years, but gave it up. Because in the States, one is discouraged. You know, American doctors don't operate on you unless you've swallowed a lot of money. Then they remove it in a major operation.
Yes.
But it was also more positive than that, that I really wanted to be a writer, and I saw writing as incompatible with being a doctor. So with a certain amount of reluctance, I gave up being a doctor.
So you switched to reading English with a view to writing. What happened after graduation day?
Well, this was in 1962. I thought I was going to be drafted into the army, and so I decided that I would go as far away as possible, not to hide, but maybe an alternative occupation, you see. So I decided on Central Africa, went there, and even got letters from my draft board saying, report for your physical in Boston, you know, on Friday. I'd be back saying, you know, owing to the spring rains, your letter only just arrived, I can't be in Boston.
But where were you?
I was in Nyasaland, actually, yes. Which later became Malawi.
Mm-hmm. Doing what?
Teaching. And then Shortly after I arrived, they had what for them was a revolution, which was not a revolution at all. It was just a little bit of spot of trouble in the capital. But a lot of people were deported, and some people were persecuted. The upshot of it was that I was kicked upstairs and I was made headmaster of a school, and I eventually ended up on the inspectorate. But in Africa, you see, everyone did much better, moved much higher.
There's a story that you were eventually thrown out because you were accused of conspiring to assassinate the president.
Yes, unfortunately. It's not a true story. It was a misunderstanding, a frame-up. It would take much too long to tell. It's an interesting story, if I may write it.
My word, Louis Theroux's dad, Paul, speaking to Roy Plomley back in 1976. I'll be back next week when my guest will be the legendary makeup artist, Pat McGrath. I do hope you'll join us.
Oi, you. While you're here, have a listen to this, would you?
Forest 404.
An environmental thriller for BBC Sounds.
I'm so sorry.
Meet Pan.
Oh, I did.
She lives a few centuries from now, after a data crash that wiped out most records of life.
Shunk.
So when she finds an old recording of a rainforest, she has no idea what it is.
Forest 404. Nine-part thriller, nine-part talk, nine-part soundscape.
Starring Pearl Mackey, Tanya Moody and Pippa Hayward, with theme music by Bonobo.
Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Subscribe now.